Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. We're devoting all of today's program to the subject of human trafficking in advance of a conference that's happening this Wednesday at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center. I'm very happy now to welcome Lauren Armstrong. She's with the Polaris Project in Washington, D.C., and the Polaris Project is bringing light to the industry of human trafficking, which is a vast and lucrative world that very few of us know anything about. Lauren, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So what is human trafficking? What are we even talking about?
Well, essentially, human trafficking is a modern-day form of slavery. So it's, you know, any time that somebody is, their own will is being overborne and they're being in a situation where they're compelled to provide some type of labor or services or engage in commercial sex. And so with human trafficking, generally that definition applies to adults and minors as well. The difference being that when minors are engaged in commercial sex, there does not need to be a showing of any type of force or fraud or coercion, but the existence of minors in commercial sex in and of itself can constitute human trafficking.
So when we think of slavery, we think of, you know, people imported from Africa slaving in the cotton fields and things like that in the U.S. South. This is very different. What does it look like, and where are you seeing this?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, trafficking victims have many different faces and come from both outside the U.S. and within the U.S. Victims can be men and women, adults and minors. One example would be United States youth who are recruited into sometimes very violent and coercive traveling sales crews. Those are situations where we've seen primarily U.S. citizens who, are born and raised in our own neighborhoods, who are being kind of recruited into these situations that can become very violent and dangerous. But certainly trafficking situations that affect foreign nationals, we oftentimes see through different visa programs, so tourist and student visas, as well as migrant worker visas, H-2A and H-2B visas, where folks come over temporarily to work primarily in agriculture. So you certainly see trafficking arise in those scenarios. And then, of course, in pimp-controlled prostitution and other types of areas of the sex industry. So in addition to prostitution, you would also see maybe in strip clubs or massage parlors where primarily women are being held against their will, both, over 18 and minors as well.
Do you have any sense of the scope of the problem of the human trafficking reality in the United States?
Yeah, statistics can be a little bit difficult to rely on just because the scope of the problem is it's very much a hidden crime, and so sometimes it's difficult to place a number on it. There have certainly been a number of studies that have tried to, shed light on the issue. As far as young people who are at risk for commercial sexual exploitation, those numbers, I think, are in the hundreds of thousands. And then also anywhere, from 14,000 to 18,000 is a very rough estimate of foreign nationals who are at risk. And so some of those figures come from Department of Justice studies, Department of State studies, and other, larger organizations that are really engaged in more fact-finding and statistics.
You talked about labor in the agricultural fields. We know that there's a lot of issues with migrant labor being underpaid and undocumented immigrants and so on being exploited. Is this the same thing as that, or is it substantively different?
Well, there's definitely a fine line between what constitutes labor exploitation and what constitutes labor trafficking. With somebody who is in a trafficking situation, may be experiencing many of the same things that labor exploitation victims are. One of the main questions that we ask when we're fielding calls from our hotline and just in speaking about the issue generally is when you ask somebody, if you wanted to leave this job, could you? And if the person is not able to say that, yes, I could leave if I wanted to, you know, although it may cause some financial hardship or there may be other difficulties, if I truly feel that I can't leave a situation, you know, oftentimes that's an indicator that someone is in a trafficking situation, you know, which is just a little bit more exploitative and kind of a little bit further than what the general labor exploitation situations are, which are oftentimes wage withholding, other types of threats or coercive behavior or escalating debt.
I was reading your website, and they're just endless. I couldn't even get through them all, testimonials, stories of people who are survivors of human trafficking. Many of them are young women who have been coerced into the sex industry, and a lot of time what they do is they take their passports away, they get them into this, force them to work, beat them up, lock them in rooms, and so on. And it's something that I'm speechless. It's like unimaginable to most of us sitting here living our normal lives.
Right. Well, you know, the thing to remember is that trafficking is really a crime that preys on vulnerability. And so vulnerability can be something that arises through someone's young age, their naivete, also through their undocumented status or just unfamiliarity with a new country or a new place if they're being moved from one location to another. And so oftentimes in situations of trafficking, the trafficker will exploit those vulnerabilities by, you know, not only through physical abuse and restraint, but also lots of severe psychological manipulation and instilling a sense of self-blame and shame, particularly with young women who are coming from cultures where, you know, participating in commercial sex would be frowned upon, and that fear of isolation, even if you were to return to your community of origin, is so overwhelming that oftentimes, you know, those are very huge factors to take into account when somebody really feels that they can't leave a situation, even if they're not necessarily being locked in a room.
When you look at the international scene, and again, I know you, it's hard to get numbers and statistics on this, just as it is on any utterly illegal industry or mafia or whatever, there's no paperwork and so on, but what does it look like in the rest of the world? Where are the worst places and what's happening there?
Sure. Well, the U.S. Department of State issues what's called the TIP report, the Trafficking in Persons Report, every year, and it's a very exhaustive bird's eye view of the state of trafficking across the world. And in that report, there will be country narratives that go through and evaluate efforts of protection, prevention, and prosecution of trafficking in that given country. And so, you know, that's certainly one source of information on kind of what's happening in a given country. And certainly the statistics are very difficult to come by, but you know, Kevin Bales with Free the Slaves had published a book and done some very extensive studies as well. And I think one of those numbers that had come out several years ago was 27 million as you know, a number of folks who are in slavery worldwide. So it's certainly a concern in every country, both developing and developed. And so one of the things to remember is that countries may be a source of trafficked individuals, it may be a country of transit, or it could also be a destination country, somewhere where there is a demand for, say, cheap labor or commercial sex. And so as a result, you see that really just about every country has a particular challenge that they're facing with respect to trafficking.
Again, looking at the testimonials, there's so much of an emphasis on the sex trade. Is that the largest, are those the largest numbers of people being trafficked, these young women?
Well, certainly, I think many of the testimonies and the cases that arise affecting female victims of trafficking do relate to the sex industry, but certainly labor trafficking is something that affects women as well. One of the primary industries will be with domestic servitude. Young women, you know, both under 18 and adult women, who are oftentimes brought into the country perhaps to work in the home of a diplomat, or, you know, other women who are here who are seeking employment as nannies or domestic helpers, who find themselves in situations where really their schedules, their lives are being controlled by a family whose threats of deportation or actual violence are so overwhelming that somebody really is in a situation of modern slavery. So, you know, with labor trafficking in addition to sex, that's one scenario where we see more frequently women are affected.
Do the people who are employing these women, whether they be for sexual services or for nanny services or people working in the houses of diplomats, I mean, diplomats, do they know that they've got slaves?
You know, I think the term slavery is very shocking for people to hear, you know, when they're speaking about these types of situations. And frankly, you know, there are certainly a number of folks who may justify, you know, the treatment of a person that's, well, you know, they have more opportunity here maybe, or they're getting paid something, or, you know, I'm providing some type of shelter or food for this person. And so, you know, therefore, I'm providing something better for them than they would otherwise have if they were on the street or, you know, in their country of origin or something like that. But the reality is that, you know, anytime you are exploiting somebody and using those threats and that force to compel this person to provide something that's of value to you, that has some financial value, you know, that is trafficking. And so I think oftentimes we turn a blind eye to that and maybe don't know or don't want to believe that slavery can certainly still exist, you know, in our communities, on our streets.
We're talking to Lauren Armstrong of the Polaris Project in Washington, D.C. So sometimes when people get out, and it may be after weeks or it may be after years, it's often, at least from reading some of these stories, it's often police raids, or sometimes they escape. But is justice ever served? In other words, do people get reparations for the damage and the pain they've discovered? Do their exploiters end up in prison and paying fines and things like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. I mean, there are a number of remedies that are available to victims. You know, one of the main goals through the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, and, you know, as it's adopted in certain states, is not just looking at prosecution of traffickers, but the protection and provision of services to victims, and also prevention, you know, to try to combat the crime and eliminate it eventually. So some of the remedies that are available primarily for foreign national victims are the T and U visas, the T visa being a visa that's available to a foreign national victim who is in the U.S. on account of trafficking and is willing to comply with requests from law enforcement in an investigation. So that is one remedy that's available. Also, the U visa is a visa that's available to victims of various crimes, including trafficking, so that they may seek justice. And so, you know, with that, we see there's really some of the goals being to promote reporting of crimes and also to provide remedies to victims. So that's just one example of, you know, for foreign nationals of remedies that are available.
Here in the United States.
That's correct.
And what about in other countries? I mean, there was one very poignant story of a woman who, the way she escaped was that there was a police raid. She was freed from prostitution. She was from a foreign country. She was deported back to her country, and she said, I'd like to go to the U.S. where there's opportunity, but I can't go because I have a deportation stamp, which is so ironic because the deportation stamp was what saved her in the first place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And, I mean, in each situation, you know, that can be unique, and whether somebody who is a legal advocate who's aware of those options comes in, whether they're able to come into the picture before maybe a removal order, you know, would really kind of depend on the case. But certainly, I mean, I think one of the successful partnerships that's been formed in various places throughout the U.S. is the task forces at a local level that are able to unite service providers with law enforcement to respond to any type of trafficking-related tips. And so, you know, in perhaps doing a police raid on a massage parlor or a brothel or some type of pimp-controlled prostitution or even a restaurant or nail salon for that matter, at that moment, being able to identify potential victims and really streamline the whole approach to a trafficking situation and allowing victims to be connected with service providers at the soonest point possible so that, you know, someone can be oriented to what services are available and also, you know, if they're able to assist in any type of subsequent prosecution.
To what extent is all of this on the radar screen of international bodies like the UN and governments of other countries outside the U.S. where it's happening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the UN is absolutely invested in, you know, educating and promoting the rule of law as it pertains to trafficking. Certainly, because the work of Polaris Project is focused primarily on trafficking as it occurs in the U.S., you know, we don't speak as frequently to international law and, you know, kind of how that's been playing out in the international arena. But certainly the United Nations being one organization and others, you know, through the Department of State as well, since that agency has a trafficking in persons unit. And so, you know, being able to connect with other countries that have taken on certain initiatives and kind of provide peer-to-peer technical assistance is something, you know, that we certainly are proud to be a part of, and I think, you know, starting to occur more and more. So just as we're becoming more of a global community, I think there's certainly that awareness that's being raised and trying to address the issue on a global scale, even though, you know, it really can occur on such a local level and requires a localized response.
How do you recognize, you know, here I am sitting in a cafe in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and our listeners are listening to this, and maybe something is happening right in our own backyard. How do you recognize it?
Well, there are a number of red flags and potential indicators to look out for. And certainly, you know, one of the things that our hotline does through the National Human Trafficking Resource Center is to help folks kind of work through maybe a situation that they've seen, you know, help identify potential victims and certainly take tips, you know, from folks who think they may have seen something that, you know, is potential trafficking. So, but certainly some of the red flags to look out for, you know, or questions to ask are, you know, where do you have a place to sleep? Do you have a key to your house? What are your, you know, living conditions like? Do you know, are you able to go and go out and about as you please? You know, do you have a debt that you owe to somebody? Or what happens, you know, if you're working for someone and you have a debt, what happens if you don't meet a quota or you don't, you know, make that sale or work these numbers of hours? And so even some very, you know, just basic questions can reveal kind of how horrific some of the conditions that people are living in. And, you know, we've seen time and again that many folks who are victims or survivors of trafficking might not self-identify simply because of, you know, your own coping mechanisms to really think, well, maybe this is my fault, or maybe, you know, I'm here by choice, or maybe I could leave if I wanted. So sometimes it's asking the more basic questions about what someone's living conditions are like and what their relationship is like with someone who could be a potential controller, whether that's somebody who puts themselves out there as a boyfriend or girlfriend or an employer, nor someone else who's in more of a position of control in that person's life.
And it does point to the importance of making friends across cultural boundaries.
Certainly. You know, with respect to domestic servitude, we know that some victims, while maybe they were living in the most horrendous conditions and really treated not even as humans, the one thing that maybe they were allowed to do was to go to church or to worship on, you know, on Sundays. And so there have been scenarios where someone was able to reach out for help and gain the trust of someone else in the community, whether it's in the faith community or somewhere else that they kind of have access to, or if somebody is allowed to go to the park, they may run into someone, and that may present an opportunity for someone to share their story. And so it really is important for community members to keep their eyes and ears open and to really be receptive if you sense, you know, that someone's not in a good place and you may be the one person that they share their story with.
Lauren Armstrong is with the Polaris Project, which is on the web at polarisproject.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Continuing now in our program about human trafficking, I'd like to welcome Carol Horwitz. She's the Domestic and Sexual Violence Prevention Coordinator for the City of Santa Fe. Barbara Goldman is with the Attorney General's Office here in New Mexico with the Border Violence Division, and she's the statewide coordinator for anti-human trafficking. And Julie Bray Morris is here. She is a clinical counselor, and she works as a volunteer to train caregivers who are working with survivors of human trafficking. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So there is a human trafficking, let's see, it's the fourth annual Faith Summit on Human Trafficking happening this Wednesday, the 6th of October at the Santa Fe Convention Center. Carol, tell us about this summit.
Well, ever since I took the position with the city of Santa Fe, we've tried to do some sort of faith-oriented event in October, which is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And since I've also been working with the Santa Fe Coordinated Community Response Council, I have been participating in a work group on human trafficking, and I've been learning more and more about it. And this year, the group, the faith work group and the anti-human trafficking work group, decided they wanted to join forces and have a faith summit focusing in on human trafficking. And the reason why we wanted to do that is because for victims of human trafficking, sometimes they're able to still continue to practice their religion and go to their churches and different religious organizations.
Right, as Lauren Armstrong was mm-hmm. telling us.
Right. So we really wanted to make sure that our faith leaders understood how to recognize signs and symptoms of human trafficking. So we've invited Lauren Armstrong. We're going to have Julie Bray Morris also presenting, and it's going to be the morning of the 6th. We're going to have lunch, breakfast and lunch, light breakfast and lunch, and it's going to be an incredible morning. And we hope lots of people from the community will find an interest in this topic, which is a very, it's just as Barbara Goldman always says, it's where domestic and sexual violence was 30 years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah, so we're really trying to raise consciousness about it.
I mean, I have to say, listening to Lauren Armstrong talk about how to recognize signs of human trafficking and what is human trafficking, I have some friends who fit that definition, and I had never put that label to it before. And I dare say if that's the case with me, it is with others as well.
Yeah. It is truly. I used to think that sexual violence was the world's best kept dirty little secret. But I know now, absolutely, that it's human trafficking. When I go across the state, I have to tell you that every single place I've been, and we're in all 13 judicial districts educating about the phenomenon of human trafficking and how to recognize it and what to do about it. I've never been any place where anecdotally people haven't said, oh my God, now that you say what it is, I should have known this from before. And this is legal, law enforcement, and social service. Universally, people don't know about it. And it's one of those things that many people, once you know about it, they don't want to talk about it. I mean, they don't want to wrap their minds around something, because to know that there is slavery, modern day slavery in the United States of America, and in fact, there are more slaves in the United States of America than there were during the entire 400 years of the transatlantic slave trade. Can you imagine?
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's
crazy. I mean,
crazy.
There's a lot more people.
No, proportionally,
here.
Per capita.
Yeah.
I mean,
there are
more literally and figuratively. Mm-hmm. I mean, United States of America, I am horrified to tell you, is the number one demand country for slaves. And this is a supply and demand phenomena.
So you are working with the Border Violence Division. You are taking on this issue specifically in the state of New Mexico. I know you can't divulge anything confidential, but in broad strokes, what are we talking about here in New Mexico? What are we looking at?
We're talking about a state that's the fifth largest in terms of land mass in the United States. And we have huge open borders between ourselves and Mexico. And Mexico is a portal of entry. And they're not just Mexicans are coming over. There are plenty of domestic slaves in the United States of America. But through Mexico, they come from every place you can imagine. Name a country, and they're bringing slaves in, and mostly through Mexico. And because we are such a large landmass with such porous borders and so few agents to patrol the borders, we are a portal of entry. Mexico is, and then New Mexico becomes a portal of entry.
From which people go to all parts of the U.S.
People are humanly trafficked all over the United States, and they're moved from state to state to state. They don't speak the language. They generally don't even know where they are, because this is a very sophisticated industry. It is the second largest illicit industry in the world.
After drugs.
After drugs. Mm-hmm. After drugs.
So what kinds of jobs are we talking about? I mean, again, we've got into this to some extent with Lauren Armstrong, but is it primarily women in sexual trafficking, or what does the picture look like?
That's a large piece of it, the sex industry. You find them in domestic situations like nannies or servants. You find them in sweatshop factories, in construction, in farm work, in fisheries, in hotel or tourist industries. You see them in panhandlers. I mean, ever since I learned about this, and by the way, this is a relatively new phenomenon in the light of things in focus. We didn't have a human trafficking bill until 2008. So we're just now spreading the word, and it's absolutely right. I mean,
but we had human trafficking.
Absolutely, but we didn't know what it was. We misdiagnosed it.
Has this been
all
going
the time
on like the whole 20th century? Is this a phenomenon of the last few years?
It's been going on from time immemorial.
Well, right.
And
I mean,
in the U.S. In the U.S., it's been slaves. I mean, they were recorded during the Civil War, but there were plenty of slaves before that, and there has been a continuous stream of humans who are slaves from that time on to this very day. And the other place that they're found is the janitorial services and restaurant services. So a lot of labor trafficking, a lot of labor trafficking.
So in Santa Fe, it is possible that if you go over to some very nice person's house who's having a cocktail party and there are some very nice Mexican people serving you drinks and hors d'oeuvres, that these people are virtual slaves.
It's very possible, don't you think? Getting lots of nods here.
Yes. Julie, you are a counselor, and this is an issue that you've really taken on kind of as a private citizen, somebody who cares. How did you get involved in this whole subject?
Well, I think I was telling Carol earlier, my parents were missionaries overseas in Papua New Guinea and came back to the States and worked in the nonprofit sector. So I grew up with a real attitude of service from my parents, and I was actually on holiday in Puerto Vallarta reading Kevin Bale's Disposable People. And that is a really good entry-level book for anyone who is interested in learning more about trafficking in persons or human trafficking. And it defines the different types of trafficking. It looks all over the globe at the types of trafficking that are happening from in Africa, Asia, the United States, everywhere. And once I knew, I couldn't forget I knew. And I'm one of those kids that, I was one of those kids that watched Roots. Anyone remember Roots?
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't read the book, but I saw it on TV. And it really shook me up. And I thought, I was born in the wrong time kind of thing. You know, like, this is my issue. And so in the year 2000, I was able to go to West Africa and kind of observe what World Hope International, a non-government organization that my family is affiliated with, what they were doing in a variety of different issues, but human trafficking was one of them. And in 2005, I'd finished graduate school as an expressive art therapist. I had my beginning licensing degree in counseling and working here in New Mexico. And they contacted me because the research was indicating that expressive arts was a very good medium to work with people specifically in Cambodia. And so I developed a training curriculum for caregivers that worked with children ages 2 to 12 that were rescued from sexploitation and trafficking.
Age 2?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't even, my brain won't go there.
Yeah. And so, but it was a very humbling experience for me because in Cambodia, at that time in particular, and I'm not sure if it's the same now, but because they have made some strides in Cambodia, but the trafficking industry was sponsored a lot by people in government as well as the police. And so the colleagues that I was training, they were risking their lives to do this work. So it was a very, I felt very humbled to be part of that. Being an American citizen, I was protected. I didn't have that same risk.
The collusion of police and law enforcement is a huge part of the problem, from what I can understand.
It is. It's about money. It's a profitable industry.
I want to ask you all something that I also asked Lauren Armstrong, but to what extent do the people who are the customers for these industries understand that they are employing slaves, whether it be prostitutes or domestic help or agricultural labor or whatever?
Well, I can't exactly answer that, but I think people are pretty well aware that they're participating in usury. I was speaking with a woman who had worked on the East Coast with victims of human trafficking, and she was telling the story of a family, and I think it was in China, and they had, it was a very poor family, and someone had approached them and said, we can take your daughter to the United States. She was 10 at the time. We can take your daughter to the United States, and we'll get her a great education, and she'll just be so much better off than she will be here with you. And the family, wanting the best for their daughter, sent her off with these people. And they knew exactly what it was that they were doing, and they brought her back to the United States, and she served as a slave in the home, and she was also passed from family to family as a sex toy, basically. Now, I can't believe anyone could have sex with a 10-year-old without knowing what it was that they were doing. And I don't know, you two can probably speak more to that, but people know what they're doing.
It's all about greed, and it's all about following the money. I mean, what could be cheaper than a slave? Mm-hmm. Somebody that you don't have to pay, somebody that you don't have to look after, and somebody who's an expendable commodity.
Yeah.
And that is particularly true in the sex trade.
This is something where when you think about, when I think about your work, Julie, as a counselor, and the process of healing from something like this, it's got to be crazy difficult to heal from those kinds of wounds, particularly when they're early middle childhood wounds.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one thing that was really tricky about working in Cambodia, as I was taking some Western counseling concepts and translating them into a different cultural context. But the real issue of trauma and also confidentiality, those were ideas that we had to talk about as a collective group and figure out what they meant in Cambodia and how those caregivers could respond in a culturally appropriate way. But we educated a lot about PTSD and the symptoms it was 35 people that I trained there, and they were all very receptive and open. And because of the history of Cambodia, I did a lot of experiential work because many of the caregivers were also recovering from their own trauma, survivors of Pol Pot, that whole era.
And so the concept of post-traumatic stress disorder was not exactly foreign to them.
Not experientially at all.
Yeah.
And last year, my family and I went to South Africa. I was offered a job in Cambodia, and it was my dream job, as funny as that is. Being a parent of two teenagers, it took me about a month to realize that I couldn't parent and do that work effectively. It's just too intense. So we decided as a family to go to South Africa and to volunteer with the same NGO. And in this case, we went in and we went into schools, and my two children also participated in the presentations. And then we also went into community outreach organizations, and we trained outreach workers who would go into the community and educate in the areas in which people were being trafficked. And part of the idea, and this has been in the press a lot, was that because of the World Cup, the issues of trafficking, the numbers just rise whenever there's a huge global sports event.
Yeah.
And so so we went into the areas where people would be trafficked internally to educate them. And almost everybody, no one had the common language,
right.
But once you talk about it, they're like, oh, yeah, I think that happened. And the really encouraging thing is while we were there, two outreach workers were able to identify at least two victims of human trafficking and get them into recovery services through the organization that we were working with.
And then, Charlotte, you know, a lot of people ask me wherever I go, well, what can they do about it? Well, the first thing is that they can learn to recognize the signs and symptoms. And I'd like to give two numbers that they could call from the New Mexico Attorney General's office. And we have special agents who investigate this, and we're very anxious to have people give us tips and leads, because we're a small office, the Border Violence Division, so we count on the community to be the watchdog, the eyes and the ears to help us. So the two numbers at the Attorney General's office are 505-827-6716 or 505-827-6042.
Talk also, and again, we talked about this with Lauren earlier, but I want to hear from you. What are some of the signs and symptoms that you've learned to look for?
Well, first of all, if you ever have an opportunity to talk to any potential victims, you need to find them a quiet place away from whomever they're with, because they're almost always shepherded by somebody who answers all the questions for them and won't allow them to interact. But the kind of question...
Well, that's a sign in itself.
You better
it?
Believe it. You better believe it. You need to ask, can you leave your job or situation if you want? Or can you come and go as you please? Or have you been threatened if you try to leave? Has anyone threatened your family? And what are your working conditions or living conditions like? And where do you sleep and eat? And something as simple as, do you have to ask permission to eat, sleep, or go to the bathroom? I mean, these are slaves that we are talking about. And is there a lock on your door so you can't get out? Those are just some of the questions.
And are your documents taken away from you?
Absolutely. Do you have documents? And do they speak the language? Are they fearful? Carol gave some really interesting topics about how to identify victims the last time we were interviewed.
Well, yeah, and I wanted to talk a little bit about why I think Santa Fe is kind of a... could be a destination for human traffickers. And as Julie was talking about the World Cup, we have enormous events here that bring people from all over the world. I think about Indian Market, Spanish Market.
Folk Art Market.
Folk Art Market, yeah. So there's a lot of international visitors. For someone who's interested in the sex tourist industry, this would be a very good place. The other thing is we have a lot of homeless teens here, and Barbara has a great statistic on this, which I'll let you give in just a second. But Santa Fe, for young people from all over New Mexico, Santa Fe is kind of a destination place, and it's also a place for people who are young people who are passing through. So how long...
48 hours is about the amount of time that a teen has before he or she will be approached about human trafficking.
Right? Do
they don't
mean?
Call
Wait.
It that.
Mm-hmm. Given, tell it, like, what does that look like?
Yeah, okay, I have to say that perpetrators of human trafficking, the traffickers, they absolutely are the smartest, most savvy people you'd ever want to know. They really do understand the mentalities of anybody that they're going after, whether
especially teenagers,
mm-hmm. but that domestically and overseas, you know, no matter what age, they know what they feed on, what they need, and they offer them all of these things.
Okay,
and
so
teenager, and let me just say that teenagers generally are running away from something, not to something. I mean, something's going on, and they're looking for love, and they're looking for a job, and they're looking for ad infinitum, whatever they're looking for, traffickers know how to offer it to them.
So,
and that's part of the manipulation.
I'm 16. My parents are drug addicts and kicked me out of the house, or I couldn't stand it anymore, and I'm couch surfing. I'm out on the street. What does the approach look like within the 48 hours thing that you just said?
You're so beautiful. You're just the most beautiful young woman I have ever seen.
And you
have you ever been a model?
And you deserve a better life.
I think you could be a model. Models make tons of money. You know, I could get you a car.
Yeah, and you need somebody to take care of you and watch over you because you've really been mistreated.
Yeah.
And sometimes they can start with the very basic. They'll see a teen sitting on a bench. You hungry? Oh, you know, here's some McDonald's or here, let's go get some food.
You look sad. What's going on with you?
And they'll sit down and they'll be your best friend until you're locked in the hotel room and can't get out.
Right, and then one of the things about victims of human trafficking is for some, like for teens, they may not realize exactly what's going on. So I love you so much, and I want us to get out of here, but I don't have any money. If you could just, like, maybe have sex with a few people.
Or maybe just go dance at a club, just one night.
Yeah.
And get paid and help me.
And then we'll go together to...
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so there's that incredible, sophisticated, slick manipulation going on. And for a young girl and... you know, you're 16 years old or you're 12 years old. There's plenty of homeless 12-year-old girls. They don't know. They just don't know. And they believe.
And traffickers know that these are kids who are willing to take risks because running away is a risk.
Right. The Polaris Project, as I was talking with Lauren about earlier, I went onto that website and started reading the testimonials of these girls from all over the place, from the United States and Armenians and Cambodians and Indonesians. Girls, it's like a weird similarity among all these stories. I mean, there are things that come up over and over, the taking of the documents, the locking of doors, mm-hmm. the giving of compliments. Everything that you guys just said, it's almost a formula. It's like there's a school for these people.
Probably is.
My husband and I went to a training to be trained to go to South Africa to do the work that we did there, and it was in Los Angeles. And the organization that trained us worked directly with people on the street, and they said it was so difficult to actually get people into restorative care because people are so connected to their pimps or the person that has trafficked them, and they love them.
And they don't believe they're victims.
And so it's getting this information out, and prevention, I think, is so important. How do we educate our homeless teens? How do we educate? And it's becoming now, and I think you might know this, it's not even a class issue. It used to be hit the lower economic bracket, and now we're seeing it across economic brackets, especially in when children are running away.
That's right.
Or and kids want to believe something. They want to believe that someone loves them.
Well, I think, like many of the issues that we end up talking about on this show, in one way or another, they're connected to things like massive inequality and economic hardship in society. Whether it be animal welfare, whether it be this, it's, I mean, one could imagine that a lot of these kids, if there were other opportunities for them, they might have the idea to make different choices.
I think that when I was in, you might know more about this, Barbara, but in 2000 when I started in this field, it seemed to be more of an economic issue. But now we're finding that traffickers are getting smart enough and sophisticated enough to go across economic brackets.
That's exactly correct. Mm-hmm. And you know, a victim is a victim is a victim.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is that there's a Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah.
Survivors of human trafficking, in my mind, are different than survivors of domestic or sexual violence. And it's more like they are victims of concentration camps. Mm. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that. But
in terms of the sophistication in recruiting, someone told me that, and I'd love to pursue this at some point, a lot of the modeling agencies that are advertised online, that's a really good way of recruiting young women who want to be beautiful. And
They're not really modeling. Mm-hmm. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Craigslist is a very fertile hunting ground.
Yeah. So, I mean, I raised a daughter, and she wanted to be a model. She wanted to be beautiful. She wanted to be on the stage, and luckily, you know, we didn't get sucked into any of that stuff, but I'm sure that was all out there when she was, 16?
Well, I think it's, as one of you said a little while ago, the consciousness about this is so much less than about, for example, rape and domestic violence, which we've talked about a lot on the show. This is the first time we've ever talked about human trafficking on the Radio Cafe, and I've been educated about it from really pretty much from zero. So you've got a big job to do in educating not only potential victims, we have a big job to do, but also law enforcement and the various public institutions of our society, legislatures too.
Right. It's about being awake and aware always and looking beneath the surface. And if you suspect something, you've got to talk to the people who are able to investigate and hopefully ultimately prosecute. And I need to say that one of the things that we're very, very excited about, in the whole United States of America, there are fewer than 300 cases, the last thing that I read, of successful prosecution of human trafficking cases. And here in New Mexico, thanks to work with our collaborative partners, we now have 3 cases that have been charged and we're in process of prosecuting. That's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. But it's the tip of the iceberg.
Absolutely. Yeah, we recognize that.
Yeah, we know that it's going on a lot more than that. And this thing that you said, Barbara, about all the people that you spoke to, I've been talking to first responders, and they're saying exactly the same thing. One guy was saying, well, you know, I work for PNM, and I had to go in and look at the electricity or whatever, you know. And this guy had to unlock all these locks on the door and everything, and there was a baby just crawling around all by itself. You know, he said, if I had known about human trafficking, I think I would have dug a little bit deeper about this. So we're hearing that every single time we talk about it. Teresa talks about a case up in Rio Riba where a young man was actually selling his sister. He was a heroin addict. So, you know, it's not precious few, it's many.
To what kind of intersection with the drug trade do you see? I mean, that's one example.
Well, one thing I do know is that a lot of victims of human trafficking do become addicted to drugs. That's a great way.
It's a tool of the traffickers.
It's a tool of the traffickers.
Keep them addicted.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's one part of it.
And the term disposable people is one that rings true with me because especially in sex trafficking, you know, someone gets STDs, HIV, their addiction gets to a place where they're emaciated, and they're kicked out. And in many cultures, these people have no place else to go. They can't return to their home communities.
Because
of the stigma associated with
they're
it.
They're tainted goods.
Yep. And I mean, culturally, that can be huge. And so then they're just left to die with no support system at all. And so interventions are really, really important. And there are many good groups doing good work out there. But I think developing a common language, emphasizing that this is modern-day slavery, that seems people, human trafficking, they're like, what? But you say modern-day slavery, people seem to get it more.
Yeah, and the first reaction is, no way.
Not here, not in the United States.
We're done with that. You're exaggerating.
Exactly. Exactly.
I wanted to just say one other thing about, just based on what, or jumping off of what Julie just said, victims of human trafficking are also controlled and stay compliant because oftentimes, like for example, this little girl from China, this person had come over, had known their family, had been maybe even a member of the community before they took the child. So that saying, if you don't do what I say that you're going to do, I'm going to go and I'm going to kill your family. Mm-hmm. I'm going to kill your grandmother. I'm going to burn down your family's house. That would keep a victim very compliant.
Yeah, and there's three things that make it human trafficking. This is not smuggling, illegal or illegal. It's not that. It's a totally different phenomenon. And you have to have the three elements of force, fraud, and coercion. That's what makes it human trafficking. And what Carol just mentioned involves all of those.
Yeah. Julie, I think you are a great example of somebody who, as a volunteer and as a private citizen, has really taken it upon themselves to educate themselves and just do your part.
Thank you. And I just want to encourage everybody else that we can all do our part. And if you are interested in learning more about human trafficking, go online, type in trafficking in persons, go to the U.S. State Department's report on human trafficking. There's one every year. It's so easy to get educated, and almost many, many groups are working hard on this issue, including local groups.
And it is easy to get educated right here in Santa Fe
by coming
to our Faith Summit. Everybody's welcome. We ask for a little donation, but if you don't have money, we want you to come. It's Wednesday, October 6th, 8 till 1 at the Santa Fe Convention Center. It's downstairs on the big fancy side of the convention center. You can park downstairs in the convention center parking lot. It's going to be, I think it's, you're going to walk away from this conference a changed person, and your eyes are going to be opened, and you are going to want to step up to the plate and really make a difference. This is, you know, we have to do it. We cannot wait for somebody else.
And after you've become educated, or you want to become more educated even after the summit, which is going to be terrific, you can call the Attorney General's office. We are excited to have people call us. We'll send you literature and information, and we want you to give us tips and leads so we can go out and do our jobs much better. We're looking to the community, to individuals such as yourself.
And what's your number over there again?
The number over there again is, I have to look at this to make sure, 505-827-6716 or 505-827-6042.
And people can always call me as well. I'm at the Santa Fe Police Department, and my number is 505-955-5018.
And that's Carol Horwitz. Carol Horwitz is the Domestic and Sexual Violence Prevention Coordinator for the City of Santa Fe. Barbara Goldman is with the Attorney General's Office Border Violence Division, and she's statewide coordinator for anti-human trafficking. And Julie Bray Morris is a clinical counselor. She works with volunteers to train caregivers who are survivors of human trafficking. Ladies, you're just amazing. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. You do a heck of a good job in helping to educate this community.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.